Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel, in the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel.
Well, Shabbat Shalom, everyone. I have a rather special message for you today, and it has to do with the gift of clear identity. The gift of clear identity. And what motivates me to share this message with you, of course, is, as Dave mentioned, Connie, who has been involved in the Messianic Jewish movement for well over 20 years, has been a faithful member here, and has demonstrated all that's required for her to actually join the Jewish people. Her experience is kind of a backdrop. Talk about the gift of clear identity. Now, this past week, had a wonderful experience with about 20 of my colleagues. We were at a Jewish retreat center in Connecticut studying Midrash. We were studying various Midrashim, and it was a wonderful experience. But at the camp, there was a kids' camp, or at the retreat center, there was also a kids' camp. I experienced an example of what I would consider very poor identity formation in the camp, and also a very positive example. So I'll start with the negative example, but there was one men's room and one ladies' room, but there weren't many ladies in men's room. The sign outside said, whatever gender you choose, choose whatever room you'd like. And I'm telling you, it struck me with great force, as this is an unintended cruelty perpetrated on all these adorable 7 and 8 and 9 year old kids who are being asked to decide something that is so fundamental to the human condition, so basic, and yet something which at that age can be prone to all kinds of confusion. And I felt it was really an unfortunate thing that kids are being asked to make those kinds of decisions. Well, from my point of view, God made male, he made female. Yes, there are people with genuine, even physiologically rooted cases of gender confusion, but to generalize it and to project it onto this whole group of adorable kids, and they were so cute, I felt was an unfortunate aspect of the experience. On the positive side, these little kiddies, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, you know, in that general age frame, you should hear them do the Birkat Hamazon and daven the Amidah, and I felt, wow, that what a wonderful example of training in what I would consider clear identity as followers of the God of Israel, and as Jews in particular. Their Jewish identity was being reinforced in wonderful ways. So not a great example, and then a very positive example. Now, Messianic Judaism's critics might say to us, who are you to talk about clear identity? You guys are the ultimate boundary crossers. What right do you have to talk about clarity and when it comes to identity? And what I would say to that usually unarticulated question, but nonetheless it's in the air, is I would say, frankly, I feel the force of that argument. We are rather radical in some of our claims, as I'll explain. Yet we're convinced that the tomb was empty, that Yeshua is the Messiah, and we're convinced that God's covenant with our Jewish people is ongoing, and those two facts loom even larger in our thinking, but we are motivated to solve identity issues, and hence I want to talk to you today about the issue of identity. So the question is this: given the Messianic Jewish perspective, can a person not born Jewish formally join the Jewish people? Is such a thing possible? And then if it is, under what circumstances? So again, referring to Connie's experience when she underwent the mikvah on Thursday late afternoon, and we're talking about conversion within a Messianic Jewish context. Is it possible? Is it possible? Is it legit? Well, first thing I want to say about this is Judaism has always had a naturalization process. Now, you may not read about the details of it in Tanakh. You've got Ruth, and there it seems to happen more kind of casually, if you will. There's no ceremony, there's no rite of passage, there's none of the things that we normally associate with changing one's status in quite this way. There's no educational process. There's no way of concretizing and solemnizing and celebrating the event. But nonetheless, Judaism has always recognized that you have to have a way of helping people understand who they are in their fundamental identity, and there is the possibility of a person actually coming among the Jewish people and taking upon themselves the yoke of the Torah, the obligations of Torah, and the attendant privileges, and becoming fully enfranchised as a Jew. Now, again, it's never been easy. As a matter of fact, the traditional rule is someone comes to the rabbi and says, listen, I want to convert. You're supposed to send them away three times. Get lost. Get out. No, not that impolite. But no, forget about it. And then they have to come back again. No, forget about it. Nope. And then a third time. Why do you suppose that is? Well, I'll tell you why it is. It's because commitments easily made are commitments easily broken. And given the realities of Jewish history and the fact that oftentimes there's been persecution and real tough stuff, the rabbis have understood that you don't want to invite people into the fold casually, because when tough times comes, zoom, out they go. And so that's why it is tough. But again, it has been possible through a long period of education, depending on the Jewish denomination, Orthodox, most difficult, conservative, reform, Messianic Judaism, probably most like conservative, where in our case, there's a 2-year preparation process. A lot of books to read, a lot of papers to write, a lot of movies to see, a lot of meetings with the rabbi to discuss. It is not easy. And then there are other hoops that a person has to jump through. But there are also privileges. In our context, you'll notice that Connie made her first aliyah today. We would not have a non-Jewish person make an aliyah to read Torah. It has nothing to do with prejudice. It has nothing to do with anything like that. It has to do with the Torah service being the reenactment of Sinai. But Sinai is not primarily a universal experience. It is a national experience. It is an experience of a particular people who experience this covenant with God in this very specific sense. Does God love all the people in the world? Of course he does. We'll talk about that. But what I'm trying to say is that in Judaism, there's always been a means of coming among the Jewish people. So that's the first point I wanted to make. Now, the second point I'd like to make about this is that the general picture in the Bible is that conversion is not supposed to be something that the vast, vast, vast majority of believers in the Messiah are supposed to even think about. And for this, I want to turn to a particular passage of Scripture where we get the great Apostle Paul, we call him Rav Shaul, the writer of 13 parts of the 13 books in the Besorah in the New Testament, and what he has to say. So I'm going to just read you and discuss with you for a moment a passage from one of his letters, often considered the first of his letters, the first one that he wrote, to the Galatians. Now, these are people who lived in Asia Minor, and they were a predominantly non-Jewish community of believers in the Messiah. And apparently, there were some people who were saying to them, oh, it's terrific that you believe in Jesus and Yeshua, but if you really want to do it right, you should be Jewish. That they were incomplete without becoming part of the Jewish people. And I want you to notice Rav Shaul's view on this subject, which we would take to be authoritative. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you to live in the chesed, the grace of the Messiah, and are turning to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. A little bit of Greek will be helpful here. He says, you're turning to a different gospel, an allos gospel, which really is a heteros gospel. Heterodox, wrong, incomplete. You think you're doing something meritorious. You think you're doing something good. He says you're doing something awful. Ooh, what's he upset about? Wow. I mean, this is right at the beginning of the book. Why didn't he say some nice things first? But he doesn't in this particular book. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and are trying to pervert the good news of Messiah. But even if we, apostles, or an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we preach to you, let them be under the cherem, the anathema. Let them be under a divine curse. Wow, strong words. As we have already said, so now I say again, if anyone is preaching to you a gospel other than the one you accepted, let them be under God's curse. Wowie wow. He's mad. Why is he so mad? Because he senses that something fundamental is at stake here. Something so basic in terms of identity formation. Something so rudimentary in terms of God's purposes for the world that that's why he's upset. The point that he's trying to make is that the good news is supposed to be expressed for Jews as Jews, for non-Jews, for Christians as Christians, and that both are equal in the sight of God, and both supposed to bless each other. We call it the economy of mutual blessing. This is the right picture. The right picture is not that all of a sudden Messiah comes in the first century and then God wants everyone to be Jews. Because if you do that, if everyone's Jewish, no one's Jewish. You completely obliterate the fundamental nature of the people of Israel as a flesh and blood people emanating from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Instead, the picture is that non-Jews who come are related to Israel by faith, related to Abraham, Avinu, and Sarah, our mother, by faith in the risen one. And in that sense, that's the great equalizer between Jews and Gentiles. It's that trust component that is so absolutely critical. And he's upset because people are amalgamating things that shouldn't be amalgamated. That certain boundaries, which are healthy and right and God-given, are being trivialized. And so that is the picture that the New Testament presents, and one that we affirm with great enthusiasm here. It's really important. Gentile Christians, if you really want to get this right, we have a number of folks here from among the nations, and God bless you all. What God's purpose for you vis-a-vis Israel is to learn about the Jewish roots of your own faith in the Messiah. Because let me tell you something, the seat of Christianity is not ultimately Constantinople or Wittenberg, Germany, or Lynchburg, Virginia, or Rome. The seat of your faith is Jerusalem. And to the extent that Gentile believers understand and appreciate those roots, your faith can be made much, much fuller and much richer. And your role is to bless the Jewish people as the Jewish people have blessed you by giving you the Messiah and continuing to be a blessing in ways that we can be a blessing. And that is the picture that God is seeking to create. Not sameness, not homogeneity, but rather people with real cultural and covenantal differences loving each other as equals in the Messiah. Because I think it is really, really critical. The next thing I want to say, as with most things in the human experience and in God's ways of doing things, at times there are exceptions. Exceptions. Sometimes we have people who demonstrated often through decades and decades of a kind of subterranean gravitational pull to Jewish life. It's something they can't escape. It's something that's been there and they haven't known what to do with. And they've always sensed it. One way to express it is they have a Jewish neshama, like a Jewish soul. We don't know where it comes from. It could come from hundreds of years ago having ancestry that were Jewish, but it was lost because of the Spanish Inquisition and the subsequent history of people in the Western world. There's a lot of reasons, and you don't even need to know the reasons so much, but the fruit of it is this gravitational pull that demonstrates itself over a long period of time. And in our segment of Messianic Judaism, we affirm that reality. And rather than just ignoring it because of the general principle, we ask ourselves, might there even be in the Bible examples or an example which could be properly construed as kind of an exception? And thankfully there is, and I want to tell you about that now. I won't turn to the passage, but it has to do with a guy named Timothy, was a protege of Rav Shaul, and Shaul wanted to travel with him to the various Jewish communities throughout Asia, but he couldn't because Timothy was not fully Jewish. It says that his mother was Jewish, his father was not. Now we know in our day having a Jewish mother is perfectly acceptable and that could settle the issue. But apparently in the first century, there was enough ambiguity or other rules playing that Shaul felt that he was not kosher enough, if you will, to be able to bring into the center of the Jewish community, bring into the temple in Jerusalem, etc. And so what does it say? It says that Shaul circumcised him. And according to the great scholar Shaya Cohen, contemporary scholar, this was a conversion. In other words, circumcision is the ultimate quintessential act of conversion. Circumcision for guys is it. For ladies, it's undergoing the mikvah, and that's the rule. So here you have Rav Shaul apparently breaking his own rule. Remember, he said, none of you should be circumcised. If you do, you're believing another gospel. But yet in the book of Acts, we have this example of him doing this, which suggests to me that the way to understand Scripture often is that, like the human experience in general, things don't always fit in neat categories that you can just say this or that. Sometimes things are just more complex, and that can make us a bit anxious at times in some ways, but it's the way life is. It's how we experience most things. Counseling books will always tell you exactly how to raise your children. Yeah, the problem is there are exceptions to that advice sometimes. And again, it is just the human experience. Now, conversion is a legitimate activity from our point of view. Do all Messianic Jews agree with us on that? I have to say no. We represent a segment, a growing segment, and a significant segment. I think the best scholars, of course, are in our neck of the woods. But not all Messianic Jews have come to this conclusion. Some have said that it's a hermetically sealed boundary, that you cannot break it. If you do, you're doing the wrong thing. We would see the potential for exceptions. Let me tell you about some of the motivations. There's the Jewish neshama. Sometimes that's mixed with a desire for a family to become united as a Jewish family. And that is not ignoble. That is not wrong. Granting clear identity to your children by mom and dad both being Jewish, that could be a legit thing. In our synagogue, we don't make a big deal of that because there's another dynamic operating. That is, that since conversion is supposed to be uncommon, we don't want anyone to feel social pressure to do something that they're not ready for or something that they may never be ready for. I'll give a personal example. In our family, of course, Sue and I came here, Rabbi and Rebbetzin, or my wife, in 1981. Sue was not born in a Jewish family. I never, ever, and none of our friends or colleagues ever put any pressure on her to convert. But one day, several years ago, she was studying under Jamie Cowan, a Messianic Jewish rabbi. He was teaching on Jewish history, and something just happened inside of her. You can ask her. She just at that moment realized, these people are my people. She had been involved in the Messianic Jewish world for decades, had gone to Hebrew college to study. I mean, you know, Sue's very, very smart. But it was only at that moment that something awakened in her after this long experience. And it was only then that she decided to go through the conversion process. And that's the way it's supposed to be. And that's a good thing. How it works, I've talked about some of this for you. In terms of the rules of the game, there's a long study process, and we don't make it easy. We would rather most people be comfortable in their own skin and not feel they have to act otherwise, but there is the potential. This begs another question. Should I be, as a non-Jew, in a Messianic Jewish synagogue? Comes up all the time, and I know many of you have wondered about this question. And the answer is that to some extent, there will always be and should always be room for a certain number of non-Jewish people who just enjoy what we're all about and want to be helpful. and want to help us do our thing, and we're blessed by that. And so I want to affirm that reality. I want to affirm that. On the other hand, I want you to be aware of some important truths that you need to consider. Number one, if you have children, you have to think about their own identity formation and who are they and what are they. And that's a big subject, but you need to give consideration to that. It doesn't matter when they're little. It becomes an issue when they hit around junior high age, when they become self-aware and self-conscious and want to know, well, what am I? Am I a Christian? Am I Jewish? I mean, blah, 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 blah. What exactly am I? So you want to really give consideration to that, whether a Messianic Jewish synagogue should be your primary home. A better way might be to have a terrific church home and then come visit us. By all means do. By all means do. I offer that out of love for you, because I want you to have the gift of clear identity formation, whether you're an adult, but especially if you're a child. And then, how else? Well, I told a couple the other day, the young lady said, oh, we just love this congregation. She says, we're not Jewish. I said, that's wonderful. Listen, bring your Jewish friends. Let me tell you what one of my biggest concerns is as a Messianic Jewish synagogue. It has to do with the numbers game. What do I mean by that? Well, at last count, and I haven't checked in quite a long time, but last count, there were 60 million evangelical Christians in America. How many Jewish people are there in America? Does anyone know, roughly? Around six million or so, okay? Meaning that the relative number of people who might be attracted to our kind of worship is far more among non-Jewish people who have some kind of sense of Israel's role in the plan of God and maybe some level of appreciation. The distance you have to travel to appreciate a Messianic synagogue is like this, but the distance, given the realities of history and all the tough things that have happened in the Jewish community in the name of Yeshua, is like this. So at the end of the day, what are we concerned about? Well, in 20 years from today, will we be a predominantly Jewish congregation? If we end up the way some Messianic Jewish synagogues, whose theology is not clear on this point, and where the rabbi doesn't have the koach to be able to tell the truth, what's going to happen in some of those congregations, it's happened already, 80, 90% non-Jewish people, lovely people, fine people, good believers. But can you call that a Messianic Jewish synagogue? I don't think so. I think there comes a point where if we are not a covenant community primarily made up of Jewish people, then it begs the question whether we deserve the name Messianic Jewish, or Judaism, certainly. Or are we really just an altered form of evangelical Christianity in a minor key, you know, with minor key songs? These are very serious questions, and I don't think I've ever preached on them quite so forthrightly, but I think it's important for all of us to think about them and to find good answers to these things. It is my big concern. Now, what's the answer for all of us? The answer is to help our Jewish friends to take a second look at Yeshua. That's the real answer. As we run into Jewish people, invite them on Saturday morning and help our Jewish people to come to understand that it is possible to be Jewish and to be a follower of Yeshua at the same time. Ours is a tall order, friends. I want to tell you, we are challenging, within the four walls of this synagogue, we are challenging the fundamental assumptions upon which all Western civilization is built. The assumption that there's Jew, there's Christian, these are mutually exclusive ideas, like railroad tracks that never meet, and we challenge that, that takes chutzpah. And if I wasn't so sure about who Yeshua was and God's covenant with Israel, tell you the truth, I wouldn't do it. And I would ask you not to do it. But the reason I want you to do it, and I will do it, is because I think we happen to be right about the man from Galilee. We're right, and we're right about God's ongoing covenant with the Jewish people. We want you to understand the story, and my exhortation is to bring Jewish friends. Don't ask me about conversion quickly. Spend about 5 years here, and then if you sense really that this is a God thing, then we can talk about it. But I may ask you politely to wait for another oneg three times. I might. Okay, we'll see how that goes. Now, today, we're celebrating a miracle. That's right. It is a miracle that God would take a woman from the nations and bring her into the household of Israel. There's a miraculous element. Connie's welcome into the fullness of Jewish peoplehood. But there are other miracles. There are other miracles. There's the miracle of Messianic Judaism. Who would have thunk it? Who could have imagined that this movement of Jews embracing Yeshua, which seems to die out by the 4th century and really die out by the Muslim conquest a couple centuries later, that we would have this kind of resurgence, that there were dozens of congregations like us and scholars and institutions and denominations and all the rest. Who could have imagined it? It is a miracle. And there is the miracle of Christians caring enough about the Jewish people to embrace your own connection to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and Rebecca and Rachel and Leah, because believers, I don't care whether you're an Eskimo, black, white, Puerto Rican, doesn't matter what you are beloved in the Messiah. Can you receive that today? I hope so. But identity confusion can mess things up. But the point is, it's a miracle. While celebrating your identity as beloved sons and daughters, chosen from the foundation of the world, the Redeemer of all people, Yeshua. So today, in light of all these miracles, I say, let's celebrate. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Please, O Lord, our God, make the words of your Torah sweet in our mouths. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. In the mouths of your people, in the mouths of the house of Israel. And may your descendants and the descendants of your people Israel be those. Oh, know your name and study your Torah. For Messiah.